Session number 11735, Lois Hoskins, Reel 2 of 2.
Lois Hoskins, Reel 2.
You were saying about the comparison between China and Japan.
Well, there was some exhilaration in China even at the time, but the people who had means were getting out mostly, or they were sitting waiting. And we knew that many of the wealthy were converting their means into portable riches, like such as jewels, in preparation for going off to Taiwan. And our doctor, who is still there, was so discouraged. He said, "They're just fiddling their time away, waiting, and thinking only of themselves." And he was terribly concerned for the country. But when we got to Japan, I remember one of the things that was so pleasing to the eye was fruit stalls in which the fruit was arranged in rows by color. And so very neat. And the Japanese seemed to know where they were going. There wasn't any of this milling about and streets crowded with people and no discipline to the traffic and all of the things that were going on in Shanghai. It was a joy to be there, but the hour and a half that I spent there wasn't long enough to make any very great observations. I know that it was raining part of the time, and the clack of heels was pervasive as people hurried in the rain. I took a tour bus and went up to see the inner and outer moats of the palace. It was just one gray blur because of the mist and the rain. But I could say I'd been in Tokyo. And the tour guide, they had one guide for three buses, and she went from one bus to the other with the same little spiel, which we couldn't understand. But we did know a little bit of what we were seeing, and I wasn't sorry that I had gone. On the way back home on the train, an American soldier got on, and he had with him a tiny little girl. I mean, she was full-grown young woman, but a tiny Japanese compared to him. He was big and blonde, and she was small and dark. She wore a hat with a wide brim, which she had pulled down so low that you couldn't see her face, and she sort of scurried after him and sat down close to him at the back of the train. And he apparently was feeling criticism because he announced, I think there was some lack of freedom in it doesn't come between Americans and Japanese. They weren't supposed to be socially active in interacting, but he announced defensively to anyone who wanted to listen on the train, "I'm going to take her home with me and marry her when this is over." And that was my impression of occupied Japan.
Yes. When the time came for you to go, you know, this journey you've been describing home, were you ready to leave China then? You know, I was wondering how worrying the situation was for a young woman with two small children and her husband so actively engaged in trying to peacemake between the different groups.
Well, I was willing for Lewis to go home in advance if he would take one of the children with him, that is, our older child. And because I wasn't sure how I would manage. We had planned to go home by way of Europe and have a really good time, so that was a disappointment. Most of our workers did that. But I took the 13-month-old, and he took our 4.5-year-old, and she flew home with him and was left with his parents while he went on to Washington. But I thought it was great on the boat. I was put in a cabin with a couple of missionaries, women, and the child had a crib. And there was a diet kitchen with everything in stainless steel and every brand of baby food and milk in the cupboards. I had nursed that child until we got home because it was the only source of milk in China, except on the black market, powdered milk. there was a sailor detailed to squeeze a gallon of, or 5 gallons of orange juice every morning and put it in the bottom of this stainless steel refrigerator. And I couldn't understand why all these Navy wives and children were so, were grousing so about the situation. But then I learned that they were, some of them were put down in the hold in the bunks, and everyone was feeling badly, and I was, must have been very fortunate by comparison. The other thing was there was a PX on board, and we hadn't been able to buy anything, although what personal money we had we saved to spend just before coming home. But with the PX and fixed prices, we fared very well. And they were fixed to the point where the inflation didn't affect them. There were reasonable prices with the money that I had. Inflation had gone right out over the top just before we left. You've heard all about that, I'm sure.
Did it make life very difficult for you in the hostel?
Yes, toward the end, our cook was finding it more and more difficult to bring food from the market. There weren't so many of us there, but one day he brought home a live goat, which he tethered, and he fattened it up. And he went out into the country and negotiated for broken rice and was very apologetic to bring us broken rice. And we put it in bags up in the attic, up through the trap door in some chests that were up there, because he thought that necessary to protect it. I don't remember that we were faring too badly. We had some canned goods. But we always felt constrained, because we were able to care for ourselves. And just outside the gate, there was so much suffering. Our servants sometimes, I think, questioned that we were well clothed and fed when we had come to help the people. I realized that the old Amma was unraveling socks and knitting them up again for the children, and that she had taken our tea towels and to make little undershirts for the children of the gardener and the washing woman. But we couldn't say them nay.
Yes, it's relative really, isn't it? Because from what you were saying earlier, you know, that you were still breastfeeding your youngest child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there must have been a certain anxiety for you, I would think, you know, being a mother myself with small children. Was it, you know, rather difficult towards the end for you? Were you worried about the children? And you know, I was wondering also the war activity. That must have been very immediate when the communists were sort of sweeping down.
There were rumors flying. And if one could believe them, the communists were in Nanjing and they would soon be at our gates. That's why the Navy wives and children had been sent home. They were burning records in Nanjing, and the Navy were sending home their wives. But actually nothing was happening, and nothing did happen about the defense of Shanghai. I think, the way I heard it, some wooden defenses were built outside the city, but they were not effective, because there wasn't... It never came to that.
Did you yourself, you know, you've given a good idea, I think, of the Kuomintang and the situation, you know, just before you left. Did you yourself meet communists?
No.
Or see them? Did you ever?
No. We had a few cases, and any of the men could tell you better about this, I expect, of students that came, particularly in Nanjing, the students were active, and they were being snatched away for their activities, the leaders. And there were one or two shadowy figures flitting around in the bedrooms that were being assisted to get out of the country. And missionaries were doing this too, missionaries who understood the nature of the situation. I've told some stories.
How about the friends? Did they help in that way, do you think?
You mean...
To help, you know, young people escape, say, the Kuomintang being dragooned.
You mean the friends' missions?
Yes, or the friends, you know, the different groups of your own organization, for instance, that you were with.
Well, this was mostly done unauthorized because there wouldn't have been time to communicate, to get any permission or even to explain the situation safely. It had to be done most discreetly. And it didn't happen very often, not in any masses at all. but there were cases, so many cases we heard about of students just being snatched into oblivion.
Were you aware yourself of partisan feelings, you know, while you were in China, particularly towards the end, towards one group rather than another?
I'm afraid so. Yes, we, nonpartisan as we were said to be and as we said we were, we saw that the mandate of heaven was shifting. That the thing was that the stories that were being carried back to America were not what we were seeing. And Lewis's experience on this track, seeing that the communists were winning the hearts of the villagers, and they were doing it in really fair ways, that corruption seemed to have undermined what might have been a regime that could help, that really helped the country. We were only trying to make some representation of what we saw as the facts. When we, every paper, every report that we heard or read from San Francisco was quite different from what we felt we were seeing and what we thought the situation was. And when we got home and we were interviewed by newspapers, the questions were asked in such a way that they got the answers that they already wanted. And it was not possible, really, to change that tide, that trend.
Was that frustrating for you?
Yes, it was. We protested rather loudly in our own families.
Yes, it's very interesting, you know, when I asked you the question about partisanship, that you were almost apologetic for feeling that way. But should you be, you know, is it necessary for Quakers always to try to be in the middle when you see the reality of a situation?
Yes, I think so. I don't profess to know enough about economics and about the various factors in ruling, governing a country. I'm learning maybe a little in my years, but we just knew that China was so chaotic and that the exploitation of the common people had been such that they would eventually have to make a change. There were some few who thought it could be done peacefully, gradually, who had dreams. And some of our Chinese unit members came to us, having worked with these small organizations and had their dreams. But I think we almost welcomed the thought that there was going to be some order brought. I'm sure we did, out of the chaos. And we didn't think that the motivation was so bad.
The work that was done in China, you know, during the years you were there, Lewis, how would you assess that, you know, the sort of contribution that was made? You explain the great chaos there, you know, and what an enormous challenge it must have been.
It was only a drop in the bucket, you know. I hope some of that work remained. And the fact that they tried to establish a model village up there in the center of China, a textile factory and a animal husbandry to upgrade their livestock, the hospital, whatever else, those things could go on without us. And I'm sure that some of them did, the communists, or somebody came in and ate the livestock by mistake before they knew what it was for. And, of course, some of the unit members went on into the cooperative movement. And you heard all about that, I'm sure.
With Rui Ali, was it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Did you know him yourself?
I didn't meet him, no. And he died while we were there in 88. But he'd been there a very long time. But we did. They had a reunion while we were at Chengdu. Two of the New Zealanders were just coming back from this reunion of the co-op effort and commemoration of Rui Ali's life and that of some others. And they were so exhausted because they'd been on such a high, they said, all the time they were there, that it was interesting to see. These were older men now, but I could see the youth in them that had been restored by their getting together with their Chinese counterparts. And the co-ops, I think, could be fostered a great deal more in China. When we were there in 88, we visited an optical co-op, and they had glasses, spectacles running over that needed to be discovered and allocated. And while we were teaching, some of our students couldn't see well enough to see from the back of the room to the blackboard. And I would so like to have sent them to co-ops. You know, they couldn't afford to buy. The thing was, and it was mentioned in the newspaper, that the foreign spectacles were thought to be so much better that people would save up to buy them rather than, and maybe didn't even know. The government should have done something about it, being the kind of government it was. One thing Lewis may have told you about the museum in Xi'an that commemorated Helen Snow's 80th birthday by doing a review of the co-op movement as it had affected the war effort. When the Japanese came and bombed the port cities and destroyed their means of replacing war materials, the Chinese, the communists, they had to find ways to equip their armies by their own efforts. And they organized to raise sheep, to grow wool, to make yarn, to weave blankets and puttees and uniforms for the soldiers. And life was very difficult for the Etrude Army, and it's a wonder that they won that long battle.
The effects of this experience on your life, Lewis, would you say it's been important, China?
Important to me, China experience.
Did you learn lessons there which have stood you in good stead?
Oh, yes, I'm sure. We've always said that China was a growing up experience for many of us, and the challenges you would never have at home, you had to rise to. Anyone who didn't became ill and went home, and there weren't very many of those. There was a lot of heroism. I didn't feel my part was, but yes. An understanding, well, I grew up in a situation where my parents were homesteading and life was quite primitive, or would be considered so on the eastern side of the United States, or in England, I think. But my mother had been of a generation whose parents had also gone westward and homesteaded another step, and then my parents went on farther west. She had the skills, the necessary skills, like making soap. She never had to in her life, but her mother had. And her education had to stop with a Quaker high school or academy. My father went to college and graduated at the age of 27, having worked his way through. But I could so empathize with the Chinese people because we had so much in our country that was not essential to life. And at first, what you saw when you went to China was the squalor, the misery, and the deformed people, and disease that was so evident. And then you began to realize the survival techniques and the spirit of the people. And they didn't know anything else, although they had dreams. And I'm sure that's what carried them through the revolution.
When you went back later, you know, your later visits to China, how did you feel about it? You know, did you think it was a good thing, after all, that the communists had won, from what you saw of Chinese society compared with, say, 47, 48, uh-huh. with the squalor and the beggars yeah. and other uh-huh. things?
Well, yes, we had seen what happened in our country to cut us off from China, and the nearest that we had come was 67 when we were in Hong Kong, and goodbye things that had printed in the border, not made in mainland China. It had to be, or we were not allowed to bring it home. And it seemed so stupid to us, and we'd been through the McCarthy era, too, in our country, and we knew that a lot of people had been really victimized. I'm sure Lewis was on the list, as well as others. And your question was?
When you actually returned to China years later, and yes. you know how you felt, you know, was that a good thing that happened, mm-hmm. that the communists uh-huh. did achieve their victory?
Well, 78 was a model year, I think, after the Cultural Revolution. They were so glad to be out from under that, and they were just pulling themselves out, getting back together, and trying to get on with the original dream. Forbidden City was open to Chinese tourists, and there were crowds passing through. The Great Wall had vacationers, you know, with bags of apples up there for the day. And it was just good to see the Chinese people with the restraints off. Some things weren't so well known to us at that time. Later, when we had a chance to hear how students were feeling again, and our students were also teachers, we knew that new generations were coming up that somehow had not caught the dream and instead were feeling the repression, that perhaps another wave was coming.
In terms of welfare, you know, clothing, housing, hygiene, public health, were things much better when you went back? You know, had there been an improvement?
Yes, yes. And we brought home a collection of posters, which we treasure, that were illustrations of public health. And they had poetry on them in Chinese for children, just little jingles to encourage them to wash their hands before eating. And there were also posters, lovely colorful posters of the paramedics visiting in homes. They were usually up on the top of a mountain, and you could look off and see these wonderful views. But she would be playing with the children, and there would be a pot steaming on the fire, and everything was very tidy. There were pictures of communist workers talking to students, and fields of grain in the background. Everything was so clean and wholesome. Let me see. Yes, the flies and the pits of night soil were not so evident. We called it the national air of China. Out in the country where we were, out on the edge of the city, we were just surrounded by fields, and spring odors were particularly noisome. What else? We were taken to see a series of medical hospitals and medical services. And some of it was way out in the rural areas. We actually went back to Yan'an, up in the cave capital. But, even in the places where it was primitive, the buckets were clean, and the walls had been whitewashed. It seemed to us that they were doing the best they could with the standards that they were allowed. And we were hurt. We're told that the paramedics went in for further training at six-month intervals, and that they really were chosen as charismatic people in the villages because they could win the hearts of the people.
Your involvement with the peace movement today, you know, I was wondering, probably you've been over here since the Gulf Crisis started.
Yes.
But I wonder, you know, in the States, if there's any sort of anti-war movement ongoing at the moment. Do you know about?
Yes. I don't know what Quakers are saying officially, but they're certainly wanting negotiation and have been working for a long time to try to bring the elements together in the Middle East. I know that the demonstrations are pretty equally divided between that and nuclear power in our country. You quite often have very effective demonstrations against reactivating nuclear plants, or also nuclear waste is a very dangerous subject.
Yes. Do you think the environmental, you know, environmental issues are now much more closely linked to peace issues? Is there?
I think so. And Quakers have done that. And this term, the integrity of the earth, is now a part of their most official statements. That is where we're all worth working for.
Well, Lois, thank you very much indeed for telling me about your very interesting experience and idea. Thank you.
Well, I hope it's been helpful.
It certainly has. Thank you.
Thank you.